Did you hear about the Welsh tourists who got drunk and stole a penguin named Dirk from SeaWorld on the Gold Coast? Or the Canadian guy who tried to beat a breathalyzer test by eating his own underpants? Hey, I'm Tara Saraban from World's Dumbest Criminals, an upbeat podcast about deadbeat crims. Join me every Monday to hear about the most ridiculous, bizarre, and downright stupid crimes and criminals in the world ever. Like the Australian man who put out an unsuccessful hit on his wife and freaked out when she crashed her own funeral. Or the Chinese woman who deliberately ran 49 red lights in her ex-boyfriend's car. World's Dumbest Criminals is available on iTunes, Spotify, and anywhere else you listen to podcasts. Make sure you subscribe if you don't want to miss any criminally stupid shenanigans.
Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners. Today's episode is particularly graphic and disturbing. I will also be discussing sexual assault. Listener discretion is strongly advised. I hate writing about serial killers. Don't get me wrong. I find them as interesting as the next true crime lover, especially the infamous antiques, as I call the older cases. Serial killers typically prey on the most vulnerable people. Sex workers, the unhoused, runaways who become does, people who have nothing mooring them to society. Usually there is little biographical information, so it is difficult to flesh them out as a person before they became a nameless, faceless victim, a number in a horrific collection. I need to find the humanity in a case, and with some serial killers, I feel like I am just listing their victims. The graphic details wash over me and make me feel numb. That's why I prefer small town or little known cases. Gainesville, Florida isn't a small town. More like a small city, anchored by the University of Florida. But it is a college town. And I am familiar with those. I grew up in one. With safe sidewalks shaded by flowering trees in the perfectly manicured medians. The illusion of safety. That's what the Gainesville victims had. The illusion. They also had families who loved them and were devastated by his short but vicious summer of terror. They were fresh-faced college students, the girls next door, which made the grisly string of murders harrowingly cinematic. It wasn't surprising when news reports of the murders inspired Kevin Williamson to write the screenplay for the horror movie, Scream. Welcome to episode 133, The Gainesville Ripper. Towards the end of August in Gainesville, Florida, the days are still hot, in the 90s, and often muggy. The humidity will stay with you in the evenings, on really muggy days, even as the temperature drops between 65 and 70 degrees. August 23, 1990 would have been a hot day for new roommates Sonia Larson and Christy Powell. The girls were finishing moving into their off-campus apartment. 18-year-old Sonia and 17-year-old Christy were set to start classes at the University of Florida on August 27th. They had met earlier that summer and decided to room together with one other girl. Student dormitories on campus were full, so they found a place at the Williamsburg Village Apartments in Gainesville. The apartments were on 16th Street, just a couple of blocks from campus. Sonia's mother, Ada, still hated that her daughter had to live off campus. On the evening of August 23, 1990, Sonia called her boyfriend from a payphone because the girls didn't have their phone line connected yet. This sounds so strange in the days of cell phones, when we don't even see payphones around anymore. Sonia had promised to call her mother soon as well, hoping their line would be installed the next day, which would be a Friday. But either way, her parents knew she would check in soon. Sonia was very close to her mother. They had dreamed of becoming schoolteachers together, and it had all worked out. Ada was starting classes that fall, too, at Florida Atlantic University, only about 10 minutes from their hometown of Deerfield Beach, Florida. Sonia Jane Larson, born in January of 1972, was the youngest of Ada's three children. James Larson managed an apartment complex and a marina in Deerfield Beach to support the family. Ada and Sonia were always close, and they were both very involved with their church and sang in the choir together. Sonia was an honor student, played softball, and was a member of many clubs. She loved children and was said to have a special way with them, working at her church daycare for 3 summers before graduation. She was also a very gifted artist, but her heart belonged to teaching. She was majoring in early education at UF. Sonia told her boyfriend she was excited about the apartment. They talked about how she was going to visit him that weekend. He was attending Maryville College in Tennessee. She hung up, tired but happy to be settled in her new apartment. Her roommate Christy, short for Christina, was also settling in. Born in November of 72, she was still 17, on the edge of 18, and excited to start freshman classes. She was one of 7 children. Frank and Patricia Powell had already lost 1 son, Michael, to leukemia in 1982, when he was also 17 years old. Like Sonia, Christy was also a star student, graduating from an Episcopal school in Jacksonville. She played volleyball and softball and had dreams of becoming an architect. But instead of dreaming of skyscrapers, Christy wanted to design housing for the poor. Sonia and Christy's apartment had 2 levels, a living room on the bottom floor and bedrooms upstairs. On the night of August 23rd, Sonia went to bed upstairs in her room, but Christy fell asleep on the couch downstairs. In the early morning hours of the 24th, a man jimmied their door open with a screwdriver. As he crept through the downstairs, he saw Christy sleeping on the couch. He stood over her, staring for a while, but she never woke up. The man decided to go upstairs, where he found Sonia sleeping. He pulled out a knife, similar to a hunting knife, and began stabbing Sonia. As she fought back, he put duct tape over her mouth and continued the vicious attack. She was conscious for about a minute before succumbing to her wounds. Then the man went back downstairs to where Christy was still sleeping. He put a double strip of tape over her mouth and then taped her hands behind her back. He cut off Christy's clothes with the knife and raped her while holding the knife on her. When he was finished, he made Christy lie face down on the floor near the couch. He then stabbed her 5 times in the back, killing her. And then he slipped back out into the night, like a ghost. No neighbors saw him or heard any screaming. On August 26th, 3 days since anyone had heard from them, Christy and Sonia's parents were getting worried. They knew the girls were waiting to have their telephone hooked up, but it wasn't like them to not call and check in, even if it had to be by payphone. These were teenagers, off to college in another city. Of course, their parents were worried. The Powells, who lived in Jacksonville, decided to go check on the girls. They were the closest, with the college being only just over an hour away from their home. They banged on the door, but everything was still and quiet, so they found a maintenance man and asked him to let them in the apartment. He called the manager, a woman named Betty Kernut, who said they had to enter with the police. As a police officer watched, the maintenance worker broke down the door, and Betty followed right behind him. Betty saw one of the girls' bodies lying in a strange position and immediately walked back out. But the maintenance man came out screaming, "Oh my God," and then threw up. Betty told 2020, quote, "And the sad, sad part about it is that we had the parents behind us on the stairs." Not long after the police arrived, the girl's 3rd roommate showed up to a shocking scene. Investigators found Christy's body downstairs first, on the floor of the apartment. She had been raped, stabbed, and her body had been mutilated. Upstairs, they found Sonia on her waterbed. She had been stabbed all over her torso and arms. And Sonia's body had been posed provocatively. Journalist John Donnelly, working for the Miami Herald, reported that Sonia was found nude, with her body lying back on the bed, with her feet on the floor, and her long hair was fanned out on the bed. This wouldn't be the last time the press released horrific details. Word of the murder spread quickly. So quickly that a friend of one of the next victims had called her and asked her if she had heard about the murders. She hadn't heard yet, and she would be dead within hours. I'm going to pause now for a short commercial break. As the Powells were processing their shock, the Larsons got the call every parent dreads. Ada Larson recalled screaming before she dropped the phone. She and her husband had to jump in their car and head to Gainesville, an almost 5-hour drive, numb with shock and grief. Ada remembers asking God why repeatedly. What she didn't know is that a third girl had also been raped and murdered, another college student, though she attended the community college in Gainesville, not UF. Krista Pike's body would be found that very evening, the same day that Sonia and Christy's bodies were found, August 26th. Krista Lee Hoyt was born in November of 1971, and at almost 19 years old, she had wanted to be a police officer for years. She went to school during the day and at night worked part-time at the Alachua County Sheriff's Office as a records clerk. Krista was an honor student at Santa Fe Community College. Her parents, Ann Guerin and Gary Hoyt, were divorced, and Gary had remarried to a woman named Diana. Krista actually wanted to be an evidence technician, which required a degree, so she was in school. She was an excellent student and also a very dependable employee. She never missed work. She was never late. And she lived alone in an apartment on a one-lane dirt road. On the evening of August 25th, after coming home from school and changing clothes, Krista headed out to work. She didn't know there was a man watching her. He had peeked into her bedroom a few days earlier. After Krista left, the man pried open her sliding glass door with a screwdriver. He carried a pistol and a knife, just like before, though he never actually used the gun. But he hadn't realized that Krista wasn't home yet, so he decided to wait for her. When she came in the door later that night, the man jumped from behind and put her in a chokehold. Krista was also bound, raped, and stabbed to death. When she didn't report to work the next evening, the 26th, her boss called a few times and then immediately dispatched two officers to her apartment to see if she was okay. Inside, officers found a horrific scene. Krista's body was posed. She was found in a sitting position with her feet on the floor and her torso slumped forward, and she had been decapitated. Her head was wedged on a bookshelf nearby. To the horror of her parents, details of Krista's decapitation and other mutilations were printed in the newspapers. Police chastised the press for hindering the investigation, but someone was leaking these details, and they knew it and promised to change their techniques. By August 28th, police had obviously connected the three murders and said publicly that they had a few leads. Parents, students, and residents of Gainesville had started worrying. The panic had not yet reached a fever pitch, but it was about to. Two more bodies were discovered on the morning of August 28th. Five students had now been found murdered in 3 days. The media swarmed the city of Gainesville. Choppers flew overhead as terrified students gave interviews to cameras on the ground. Detectives complained that reporters followed them as they were checking out leads. It was a feeding frenzy. Newspapers had dubbed the killer the Gainesville Ripper, probably due to the graphic details of mutilation that were printed in papers. Tracy Paulus and Manny Tabota were older students. Both were born in the fall of 1966, so they were both about to turn 24 years old. Tracy and Manny were not dating, though people assumed the good-looking pair had to be boyfriend and girlfriend. But they were actually just old friends. They had both graduated from American High School in Miami with honors in 1984. Tracy Inez Paulus was born to parents Ricky and George. George worked as a stonemason. Tracy, an honor student, had been homecoming queen and class president. She also played softball and soccer. Tracy was especially close to her sister Laurie. As kids, they made up dance routines. Watching interviews with Laurie is gut-wrenching to me. The home movies look like me with my little sister. Tracy was pre-law at UF and had worked at a law firm before enrolling in college. When she decided to go back to school at UF, rooming with her old friend Manny seemed like such a fun idea, and a safe one. Both of them had gone to Miami-Dade Community College. Manny had transferred to the Santa Fe Community College as Tracy had gone to work, before they both decided to enroll at the University of Florida. Manny had been born to Cuban immigrants, and he had one brother named Mario. Manny's dad had passed away 6 years earlier, during his senior year of high school. His mother, Gladys, worked as a cosmetologist to support the family. Manuel Tabota had been a charismatic, genial, and popular kid in high school. He played guard for the football team and was president of the thespian club. With his dark good looks, he was perfect as Danny in the school production of Grease. His brother Mario said Manny was very into the outdoors. And the two brothers, who were very different, were just getting close again that summer of 1990. Manny wanted to be an architect and was set to enroll in classes at UF for the fall semester. He and Tracy got a place together at Gatorwood Apartments, about a half mile from the UF campus. On the day after the first three bodies were found, at 3 in the morning on August 27th, the man broke into their apartment. His target was Tracy, pretty, brunette, and petite, like the other girls. He pried open the sliding glass door with the same screwdriver he used to break into Krista's door. He carried the same knife and pistol. But he was surprised when he went into one of the bedrooms and found Manny Tabota asleep. He stood over the college student and then stabbed him directly in the solar plexus and penetrated his thoracic vertebra. The solar plexus is in the middle of your chest, in the pit of your stomach, in front of the aorta. And still, when Manny woke up, he fought hard. He was over 6 feet tall and 200 pounds, but so was his killer. Manny suffered stab wounds to the arms, hands, chest, legs, and face. Tracy heard the commotion in Manny's room, so she went to check on him. When she saw the killer, she turned around and ran to her room. She tried to barricade herself in there, but the killer broke down the door. He was covered in Manny's blood. He subdued Tracy, who asked, "You are the one, aren't you?" He said, "Yes, I'm the one." Before he taped her mouth shut, he bound her hands and cut her clothes off. He held the knife on Tracy as he raped her. Then he turned her over and stabbed her 3 times in the back. Before he left, the killer cleaned and posed Tracy's body. The next morning, on August 28th, a friend called the apartment complex's maintenance office and said Tracy and Manny hadn't been seen lately. Police arrived to a familiar, grim scene. They found Tracy on the living room floor, posed, just like the other victims, and soap was found on her body, as well as duct tape residue. Gainesville was in hysterics. People were horrified and scared. It was so bad that mental health experts were brought in to help residents cope with the anxiety that they felt. Students and other young people were terrified that they would be the next victim. Many students started sleeping together in one dorm room. Things were much less scary during the day, but after the streetlights went out, panic set in. Everywhere they went, they thought they saw the Gainesville Ripper. Anyone who saw a remotely suspicious man called the police. Parents who hadn't heard from their kids after a couple of hours called the police. Every strange noise raised heart rates. Police started averaging 1,400 calls a night. That's one every minute. Women wouldn't walk alone anywhere. Newspapers stopped being delivered because people were too scared to deliver them. Pizza delivery drivers started telling their managers exactly where they were going and how long it should take them to make the delivery. Some people carried guns or other weapons like bats, bricks, bottles, and knives. Armed residents scaring each other caused even more problems. Police said they were worried an innocent person was going to get hurt. One resident told the Palm Beach Post, quote, "This guy's worse than Bundy. He likes to feel blood. He's an animal. Human beings just don't do that to other human beings." The media was everywhere. The Gainesville Ripper was national news. Students were packing up and leaving UF. Freshmen who were accepted to other state colleges were told they could transfer if they felt uncomfortable. By August 31st, campus officials had received 20 inquiries about transferring. However, around 500 of the university's 30,000 students had already left Gainesville. The students were told they wouldn't be penalized for leaving and returning to school later. Some students were able to move on to campus where they felt safer. Southern Bell sent in 20 extra workers to open phone lines for college students so they could reach their parents more easily. There were many rumors about who the Gainesville Ripper was. One rumor was that he could be a doctor or someone in the health field based on the mutilations described in the newspapers. It was like Jack the Ripper all over again. Another rumor was that the killings were related to the Exorcist 3 movie, which had recently been released. Police told the public that this was false, but it is something for you to keep in your back pocket. Gainesville police and the Alachua County Sheriff's Office called in agents from around Florida to help them investigate the murders. Around 100 investigators were working on the case. 16 of these investigators were trained in making psychological profiles, and some had worked on the Ted Bundy case. According to the Miami Herald, it was one of Florida's most intense manhunts in recent memory. As the hysteria mounted and the investigation ramped up, there were five sets of devastated parents who had to bury their children. On August 30th, Sonia Larson's memorial service was held at the First Baptist Church of Pompano Beach, where she had sang in the choir with her mother. Sonia's family had been attending that church for years, and more than 1,000 friends and family members were in attendance. The other funerals were all on August 31st. Christy Powell's funeral was held at St. David's Episcopal Church in Jacksonville. Krista Hoyt's memorial service was held at the Newberry High School Gymnasium in Newberry. Tracy Paulus' funeral was held at Miami Church of Religious Science in Dade County. Manny Tabota's funeral was held at St. Monica's Catholic Church in Carroll City. These parents grieved in private as their children remained on the front pages of every newspaper. All of them handled the trauma differently. Some stayed in the public eye, demanding justice. Christy Powell's parents shunned all public and the media. Krista Hoyt's father, Gary, had a very hard time processing what had happened to his daughter. Her stepmother, Diana, later told 2020, quote, "My husband would just sit and say, 'Just tell me she died right away. Tell me she did not suffer.'" These police officers knew Krista. They told Gary she died right away from the first stab, which was the truth, but there were many hours before that. The Hoyts also sued Krista's landlord and won a settlement of $350,000 the next year. Her apartment had inadequate locks and poor lighting. All of the parents continued to pressure the police for answers. Detectives knew there were multiple similarities between all five murders: the tape residue, the soap residue, the sexual assaults, the stabbing, and the posing of the bodies. They also noticed that the killer entered the residences through the back door, and each home was near a wooded area, which allowed the killer to get in and out without being noticed. Also, all the female victims looked similar. The wooded area detail stood out to the police. On August 27th, First Union National Bank of Gainesville, located about a half mile away from Krista Hoyt's house, was robbed. During the robbery, a teller put a red dye pack in the bag of money. Later that night, an officer saw a man walking into the wooded area. He chased him, but wound up losing him. The man had inadvertently led the cops to his tent. Inside the tent was a bag of money with red dye all over it. They found a gun and a screwdriver, and a cassette recorder with a tape inside. But because it was a gun and not a knife, they decided this man wasn't connected to the murders. On August 30th, police said they believed the killer was one man working alone and that he was still in the Gainesville area. They said the killer probably knew the southwest area of Gainesville fairly well, and it appeared that he did know whose apartments he was breaking into, meaning he had stalked his victims prior to the murders. With the help of the FBI, police released a profile of the killer. He may have killed before, he may have committed sex crimes, and he may have been in and out of prison or mental institutions. By August 31st, police had received more than 1,500 tips. A few days after the murders, an 18-year-old named Ed Humphrey was arrested for assaulting his grandmother. Police had received several tips about Ed. He was known to carry knives, he had been off of his medication, and when police searched his home, they found magazines about guns, knives, and girls. And in his mugshot, not only was his face scarred, but he had fresh scratches. The media jammed into the courtroom for his first hearing. Ed Humphrey would not be released for 10 months. He was sent to a mental institution and was never charged with any crimes related to the Gainesville murders. I read a newspaper article about Ed that was heartbreaking. He had been an honor student and an Eagle Scout before he was in a terrible car accident. He was thrown from the car, suffering head trauma and scarring his once handsome face. He was in physical therapy for a year and a half, delaying his own start to college. He used to live quietly with his mother and grandmother, but after the accident, his personality completely changed. He was menacing and started acting out. His scars scared people even more. His grandmother had to call 911 on more than one occasion before Ed battered her. Not knowing what all had happened to him, he just sounds like a huge creep that beat up his own grandmother. He was an easy suspect. One former state attorney told 2020 that Ed was the desperation of the time, the need to get that guy. We made a mistake. Then Florida police caught a major break. They had put the Gainesville killer's profile into VICAP and got a hit on his M.O. In November, Don Maines, an investigator with the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, went to Shreveport, Louisiana to meet with police there. The Shreveport police had heard about the Gainesville murders and thought they were very similar to one of their unsolved cases, the 1989 murders of the Grissom family. I'm going to pause now to hear a word from today's sponsors. For this ad break, I want you to take a break. Unclench your jaw, relax your shoulders, and take a deep breath. Sometimes we all need a reminder to just breathe and relax for a bit, and Calm can help. Calm, the number one mental wellness app, gives you the tools that improve the way you feel. Clear your head with guided daily meditations, improve your focus with Calm's curated music tracks, and drift off to dreamland with Calm's imaginative sleep stories. I often have insomnia. My mind just won't stop racing. Calm has given me an amazing way to finally relax my mind and get to sleep quickly. And if you go to calm.com/southernfried, you'll get a limited time offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription, which includes hundreds of hours of programming, and new content is added every week. Over 100 million people around the world use Calm to take care of their minds, sleep more, stress less, live better with Calm. For Southern Fried listeners, Calm is offering a special limited time promotion of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/southernfried. Go to calm.com/southernfried for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/southernfried. In life, we're all bound for different things. With beachbound.com vacations, you could be bound for adventure, bound for relaxation, bound for discovery or togetherness with your partner or family. Personally, when I'm at a beach resort, I'm bound to end up at the poolside bar, basking in the sun. As long as I've got a good view and a good drink in my hand, I'll be as happy as can be. With beachbound.com, you can find the perfect beach vacation for you, no matter what you are looking for. Beachbound is an online travel agency with expertise in worldwide beach vacations and experiences. They are reinventing beach travel. With beachbound.com, customers can book worldwide beach vacations, including flights, hotels, transfers, and excursions. They are truly a one-stop travel shop. Beachbound is committed to building the most amazing beach experiences because to them, the beach isn't just a place. It's a way of life. They thrive on making sure your getaways are unique experiences that create lasting memories with relaxation and luxury on worldwide beaches. They focus on the following experiences and ask you what you are bound for: immersion, passion, togetherness, adventure, discovery, and rejuvenation. Because whatever you're bound for, beachbound.com has it. Visit beachbound.com to book your next beach vacation. What are you bound for? 55-year-old Tom Grissom was an Army veteran who worked as a supervisor at AT&T. He was divorced and lived with his adult daughter Julie on Beth Lane in Shreveport. Tom was known as a friendly, respectable man. He was said to be an easygoing and helpful supervisor who would do anything for his employees. He also had a son named Scott who had just remarried. Scott was actually on his honeymoon the weekend his family was murdered. His son Sean was staying with his granddad. 24-year-old Julie Ann Grissom was attending Louisiana State University of Shreveport. She was studying marketing. She had transferred there in early 1989 after attending at the Baton Rouge campus. She was set to graduate soon. She had moved home when her dad was diagnosed with throat cancer. Julie is described as a warm and sweet young woman who was also beautiful. She was petite, with dark hair. Her nephew Sean had been born in October of 1981 to parents Jenny and Scott and was in the third grade. He had just celebrated his 8th birthday and was spending the weekend of November 4th with his granddad and aunt as part of his birthday present. He was supposed to go home on the 6th. On Monday, November 6th, at around 8:30 a.m., Sean's mother called the police. She hadn't been able to get a hold of Tom or Julie, and Sean was never dropped off at school that Monday morning. Police spoke with neighbors and asked if Tom's doors were unlocked. At around 8:45 a.m., three neighbors went to Tom's house. They opened the door to the utility room off the garage and saw a body, so they turned around and left. Police arrived and found Tom's body slumped against the utility room door. He had been stabbed multiple times in the back and chest, and he had been cooking steaks on the backyard grill at the time. Police found Sean face down in the family room. There was one knife wound to his back that exited through his chest. He had been watching TV when he was attacked. Then they found Julie's body naked and partially hanging off a bed. She'd been stabbed at least 3 times in the back, but her body was left facing up. There were no signs of forced entry, ransacking, or robbery. There was some indication of a struggle, but it wasn't that noticeable. Police theorized the Grissom family was killed between 6 p.m. and 8 p.m. on November 4th. The Shreveport community was very freaked out, much like the Gainesville community. Detective Maines and the Shreveport police went over the Grissom murders, and Maines realized Julie's body had been posed much like the female victims in Gainesville. There was also tape residue and the body cleaning similarities, and Julie looked a lot like the Gainesville victims, petite and brunette. DNA wasn't that advanced in 1990. However, they were able to determine the blood type through semen. Semen had been left behind at all 3 Gainesville crime scenes. It was tested and found to be type B blood. The killer was also a secretor. That's how his blood type was able to be found in bodily fluids. Again, not DNA, but at least a guiding point for the investigators. Ed Humphrey's blood type was A. Bodily fluids were also found on Julie Grissom. Detectives sent the evidence to the FBI lab and found that this killer was also a type B secretor. Not long after Maines went to Shreveport, a woman named Cindy Dobbin called the police and said she thought she might know who was responsible for the college student murders. She was from Shreveport, Louisiana. Cindy was actually on a trip through the Florida Panhandle with her family when she heard about the murders. She saw a news report, and it instantly made her think of a man she knew named Danny. Danny used to come over and hang out with Cindy and her husband. He told Cindy once, quote, "One day, I'm going to leave this town and I'm going to go where the girls are beautiful and I can just lay in the sun and watch beautiful women all day." But that wasn't why she suspected him. Danny was over one day, a few months after the Shreveport murders, outside talking to Cindy's husband, Stephen. Stephen came in and told Cindy that he wanted Danny to leave. Danny had told Stephen that he had a problem. When Stephen asked what kind of problem, Danny said, "I like to stick knives into people." Cindy didn't really think much of the comment. She thought he was kidding, and that there was no way he could be responsible for the Grissom murders. But when she heard about the college student murders, she couldn't help but make the connection. But she didn't call the police yet. Then in November, after months of being haunted, Cindy called Crime Stoppers. Police found out that a man named Danny Rawling lived with his parents in a home about 10 minutes away from the Grissom house. When police looked into Rawling, they saw he had multiple convictions for armed robbery. Now they thought he might be connected to the bank robbery that happened on the day Krista Hoyt's body was found. On August 27th, that First Union National Bank of Gainesville, a bank across the street from a wooded area owned by the University of Florida, was robbed of $7,000. The robber was a white man with a gun. Detectives realized they had a bunch of evidence sitting in a locker in Gainesville. As I said, a gun and screwdriver were found, but not the knife. However, this time, investigators listened to the cassette tape found in the recorder. They heard a man talking and singing. He sang, "Mystery Rider, what's your name? You're a killer, a drifter, gone insane." In the talking parts, Danny often talked to his family and about life and how he felt he went down the wrong road. He also talked about the best way to kill a deer. Aim for the lungs, not the heart. Then at one point, the man said his full name, Danny Harold Rawling. Detective Maines later told 2020 that police officers had never listened to that cassette tape before that moment. If they had, they would have caught Danny months prior. He said for some reason, somehow, that tape escaped us. In this interview 30 years later, the detective was still apologizing for their mistake, clearly haunted. It didn't take investigators long to find Rawling. He was already in jail in Marion County, 40 miles south of Gainesville. He was arrested for armed robbery 10 days after Tracy and Manny's bodies were found. Police had had no idea that Rawling had stolen a car and driven to Tampa after almost getting caught in the woods. While in Tampa, Rawling burglarized 3 apartments and stole another car. He left a banana peel on the seats as a calling card. On September 2nd, he robbed a Save and Pack grocery store. He had a gun and held up three cashiers. He took off with $3,000 in cash. When he left the store, he jumped into a waiting car and two police officers confronted him. When he pointed a gun out the window and sped towards the officers, they had to open fire. But Rawling was finally arrested on September 7th after robbing a Winn-Dixie at gunpoint in Ocala, which is about 30 miles south of Gainesville. Rawling had gone into the store in broad daylight. He had held a gun to the store manager's head and demanded all the money. While in jail, Rawling told police he was an alcoholic and drug addict. He said he drank two pints of rum and tequila every day and that he also used marijuana and crack cocaine. Police tested his blood and he was a type B secretor. But Rawling denied involvement with the Gainesville murders and the Grissom murders from his hometown. On November 15, 1991, an Alachua County grand jury indicted Danny Rawling with the first-degree murders of Sonia Larson, Christy Powell, Krista Hoyt, Manuel Tabota, and Tracy Paulus. He was also charged with three counts of sexual battery and three counts of armed burglary. On June 9, 1992, Rawling pled not guilty to all charges. A trial date was set for February 15, 1994. Before he would stand trial for the murders, Rawling was convicted on federal robbery charges for the August 27th bank robbery. He had mood swings while in jail. In January, he got mad and smashed a toilet against a cell window. 2 weeks later, he was talking about dying. When a psychiatrist spoke to Rawling, he said he had attempted to take his own life and had been in an Alabama mental hospital for a month in 1979. Danny Rawling was born in May of 1954 in Shreveport, Louisiana, to parents James and Claudia. His father, James, was a police officer. He retired as a lieutenant in the 1980s after serving more than 20 years. James was described as a strict disciplinarian towards his two sons, Danny and Kevin, especially Danny, who was the oldest. Rawling's mother, Claudia, would later testify that her son was severely mentally and physically abused by his father. She said James kicked Danny out of the house by the time he was 15. Claudia said, quote, "Danny was an abused child from the day he was born. My husband was jealous of him. He never wanted me to hold him or show him love. He was told from the time he could understand that he would be dead or in jail by the time he was 15. His self-esteem was destroyed by his dad's constant belittling." Rawling's cousin and a neighbor also testified to witnessing severe abuse. The neighbor recalled an incident when James beat his son and then took his gun out and threatened to kill anyone who tried to intervene. She said she took Claudia to file a police report, but claimed the police refused to press charges because it would hurt James Rawling's career. Danny Rawling was described by old neighbors as being a loner who played acoustic guitar. He jogged alone, worked out, and interacted sometimes with little kids. Some neighborhood children called him Rambo because he often wore fatigues and bandanas. Rawling dropped out of high school in 10th grade, which would have been around when his father kicked him out. At 17, he joined the Air Force, but was discharged after 2 years. Then he got married at the age of 20 and had a daughter. His wife divorced him after he pulled a gun on her, and then he stopped seeing his young daughter. Following his divorce, many people said Rawling's behavior changed drastically. He spent most of the 1980s in and out of prisons for armed robberies of grocery stores in Georgia, Alabama, and Mississippi. Police later described him as bold, arrogant, and menacing. In July 1988, Rawling was on parole for an armed robbery in Mississippi and back living with his parents. He still lived with them in their home 10 minutes from the Grissom house when the murders took place. Then on the evening of May 18, 1990, Rawling got into an argument with his father. James had told his son to roll up his car windows because it was starting to rain. Danny stormed out of the house and James followed with a gun. 3 to 4 shots were fired. James went back into the house and told his wife that he had just shot into the air. Then Danny came back into the house. James was standing in the doorway to the kitchen. Danny kicked the door in and said, "Old man, you want to shoot it out?" Claudia said she ran out of the room and then she heard shots. She went back in the kitchen and found James lying on the floor and Danny was gone. James had been shot twice, once in the head and once in the side. Police were called at 8:45 p.m. and James Rawling was taken to the hospital. He would be in the hospital for a month, left blind in one eye. Danny Rawling was charged with attempted murder and a warrant was issued for his arrest. At around 11:30 p.m. on the 18th, Rawling went to a house on Wildwood Street of Shreveport. He went upstairs and found a husband and wife watching TV in their bedroom. He pointed a gun at the couple and said, "I need your help. I'm in trouble. I just shot my daddy and I think he might be dead." He took $21 from the wife's purse and then fled on foot. The next day, at around 6 a.m., his car was found abandoned in a Motel 6 parking lot in Shreveport, but Rawling had not checked in. Danny Rawling had caught a Greyhound bus to Florida and started living in a tent in the woods. I'm going to pause now to hear a final word from today's sponsors. Today's episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. Most of you know about my back surgeries and that I survived sepsis last year. And recently, I've been dealing with some post-surgery depression. I didn't even know that was a thing until it happened to me. Depression and anxiety medication help, but I still need to talk it out with someone. BetterHelp Online Counseling has been there for me, and they will be there for you too, treating all kinds of depression and the stress, trauma, grief, and other issues we face every day. They will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist. It's not a crisis line. It's not self-help. It is professional counseling done securely online. From your phone, laptop, or tablet, you can start communicating with your counselor in under 48 hours. You can send a message to your BetterHelp counselor at any time, and anything you share is confidential. BetterHelp is more affordable than traditional offline counseling, and financial aid is available. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting BetterHelp.com/Southern. Join over 1 million people taking charge of their mental health. Again, that's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Southern. I don't know about you, but I've always got a podcast, audiobook, or music playing in my ears. It somehow gives me more privacy in public places. I don't want to hear all the sounds of the grocery store. That's why I am loving my Raycon earbuds. They came with several different sized gel tips, so I could pick the right size. Finally, comfortable earbuds that don't fall out. And the new everyday earbuds look, feel, and sound better than ever. I chose the rose gold. They are sleek and stylish, and I love the charging case with the little rope handle. It's so easy to find in my messy purse. There are three sound profiles to make sure you're getting just the right amount of bass: pure mode, balanced mode, and bass mode. It's awesome to switch modes when I go from a podcast to music. And there is a new awareness mode for when I'm not at home and need to listen to my surroundings. Raycons also have a 32-hour battery life, which is great. I can get all my chores done without having to stop and recharge. And with a built-in mic, I can take calls on my earbuds with the push of a button. They start at half the price of other premium audio brands, and Raycons also come with a 45-day happiness guarantee, so you've got nothing to lose for giving them a shot. Right now, Southern Fried listeners can get 15% off their Raycon order at buyraycon.com/southernfried. That's buyraycon.com/southernfried to save 15% off Raycons. buyraycon.com/southernfried. On September 17th, 1990, Rawling pled guilty to three counts: robbery with a firearm, possession of a firearm by a convicted felon, and fleeing a police officer. Throughout the proceedings for these charges, he waived counsel. Because the charges were so serious, the judge ordered a competency hearing. One psychiatrist diagnosed him with three possible disorders: antisocial personality, schizoid type, and psychosis. Two other psychiatrists disagreed. They found that Rawling was suffering from drug and alcohol withdrawals and was severely depressed, but they felt he exaggerated his answers to the doctors. He tested as borderline intellectually disabled, but one psychiatrist said his exaggerated antics could have thrown off the test results. Both of these psychiatrists, despite finding mental health issues, said Rawling was competent when he had pled guilty. In the coming months, Rawling was sentenced to decades for robberies and finally was sentenced to life in prison for the August bank robbery as a habitual offender. Then he was transferred to Florida State Prison to await trial for the Gainesville murders. Inside, he became friends with a notorious inmate named Bobby Lewis. Lewis had been the only man who had ever escaped from death row in a 1978 prison break. Rawling started hinting around to Lewis that he was involved with the Gainesville murders. Of course, Lewis immediately tried to get a reduced sentence to be a witness for the state. He also wanted to sell the story to a woman named Sandra London. Sandra was a journalist who achieved minor fame from writing a book with her ex-boyfriend, suspected serial killer G.J. Schaefer. After hearing from Bobby Lewis, Sandra started writing to Danny Rawling. She told the Washington Post that when she met Danny, quote, "Standing there before my hungry eyes was one gorgeous hunk of a man." She said their relationship was as deep as the Amazon River and just as wild. Sandra and Rawling were soon engaged and wrote a book together. "Haley was good enough to find me a copy of this so-called book, but I couldn't even get through the first pages. It was all bragging about Sandra's career before leaping headlong into the abuse Rawlings said he suffered from his, quote, brutal domestic tyrant. If you want to be nauseated, look for interviews with Sandra London. At one of his many hearings, Rawlings asked to make a statement. When he was allowed, he sang a damn song to the beaming Sandra as his attorney sat there looking embarrassed. It reminded me of how Ted Bundy proposed to his groupie in open court. Sandra London truly disgusts me. I have nothing against prison pen pals, but she is different. She claimed to be all slobbery in love, but she really wanted to just make money off of her new fiancé. The book led Sandra London and Danny Rawlings to be sued under Florida laws, similar to the Son of Sam law, originally started in New York. In 1998, a judge ruled that proceeds from the book, to the tune of $20,000, could be seized from Sandra, as well as Rawlings' artwork, autographs, and letters that she was also marketing. While waiting for his capital murder trial, Danny Rawlings and Bobby Lewis constantly tried to make deals with the state. The number of times they talked to the task force is too ridiculous to recite, as each time authorities refused to make any deals with Bobby Lewis to get a confession out of Rawlings. At the end of January and early February of 1993, the task force and an assistant state attorney finally met with Danny Rawlings and Bobby Lewis and actually got somewhere. The interviews were videotaped, and Lewis served as a sort of mouthpiece for Rawlings. Rawlings would sometimes lean over and whisper answers in his ear. It was during these interviews that investigators learned chilling details about the Gainesville murders. Rawlings said he had actually gone back to Crystal Hoyt's house after murdering her because he thought he left his wallet there. That is when he decided to behead her. He also talked about his fight with Manny Tabota and how he chased the terrified Tracy Paulus, breaking into her room, and when she asked, "You're the one, aren't you?" and he said, "Yeah, I'm the one." Rawlings did say he acted alone and confirmed that Ed Humphrey was not involved. During questioning, he said he dealt with different personalities all his life. He told police about two of his so-called darker personalities. The first was Enad, which is Danny, spelled backwards. One psychiatrist would later roll her eyes on the stand and say the backwards name thing was a common ploy. Rawlings said his other personality, named Gemini, was actually the one who caused him to kill. He gave police multiple motives. He said he wanted to kill one person for each of the 8 years he had spent in prison. He also said he wanted to become a superstar. Police were able to get confessions about the Gainesville murders, but Rawlings would not confess to the Grissom killings. When his first day of trial rolled around in February of 1994, Rawlings decided to change his plea to guilty on all counts. Before court got started, Rawlings said he wanted to address the court. He said, quote, "Your Honor, I've been running from first one thing and then another all my life, but there are some things that you just can't run from, and this being one of those." So they went straight to the penalty phase, which was held to decide if Rawlings should get the death penalty or life. The jury would decide between those two options for each murder, so he could potentially get life in prison for some of them and death for the others. So there was sort of a mini-trial held to decide Rawlings' fate. The state's case was that Rawlings committed the murders for one reason only. He loved it. The defense presented mitigating factors for why Rawlings committed the murders, the main factor being the abuse he faced at the hands of his father, James. As I said, his mother, cousin, and neighbor all testified about the abuse. Another factor they focused on was Rawlings' alleged mental illnesses. The defense had three psychiatrists testify that Rawlings was sane but mentally ill. They said he suffered from borderline personality disorder characterized by anger, immaturity, anxiety, unstable relationships, and mood swings. They said Rawlings supposedly believed he had other personalities, but he didn't actually have multiple personalities. He just shifted from role to role. Doctors said the abuse Rawlings had faced as a child drove him to voyeurism and violence. One doctor testified that when Rawlings was a teenager, he started spending several nights a week peeping into windows and masturbating. Rawlings had also told one doctor, quote, "The most horrifying type of death is to come in the night with a knife and you knew you were going to die." The state still insisted that Danny Rawlings was sane and just enjoyed killing. The crime scene photos shown to jurors were so disturbing that the state offered to provide counseling to the jury members. One juror later told the Miami Herald that the pictures were so horrendous and upsetting that they didn't sleep for the first 3 days. On March 24, 1994, after deliberating for 5 hours, the jury recommended, in a 12-0 count, that Rawling be sentenced to death for each murder. According to the Miami Herald, Rawling slowly rubbed his hands, pursed his lips, and nodded almost imperceptibly as the jury's recommendation was read. And just moments before the verdict was read, Rawling's fiancée, Sandra London, blew him a kiss. On April 20th, the judge sentenced Rawling to death for each murder and life for each of the other charges. Following the sentencing, Manny Tabota's brother Mario stood up and shouted, "You're going down in five. Do you understand that? In less than 5 years, we have the last say. We will prevail. Our children's names will be remembered over him." Mario later said he read that serial killers like to be in control, so he wanted to have the last word. Because Rawling pled guilty and was sentenced to death, he was never charged with the Grissom family murders. However, the Grissom case was closed in March of 1994. Police were convinced Rawling was the killer, even though he denied it. In total, 200-plus investigators, almost 7,000 task force reports totaling 100,000 pages, and $6.3 million had been spent on the investigation and trial. After many attempts at appeals, it was all over for Danny Rawling on October 18, 2006, when the Supreme Court of Florida affirmed his conviction. And in Florida, they don't play around. 1 week later, on October 25, 2006, Danny Rawling's execution was held at the Florida State Prison. Prior to his execution, Rawling was calm and cooperative. He did not take any of the relaxation medication he was offered. Before he was executed, he slipped a note to a minister. The note was a letter confessing to the Grissom family killings. And the letter was a lot of jabbering, like he was trying to write in Old English or something. He even drew big artistic letters at the head of each paragraph. But one part was clear. Quote, "Hal Carter, Julie Grissom's former fiancé, is 100% innocent, totally pure of that crime. I and I alone am guilty. It was my hand that took those precious lights out of this old dark world. With all my heart and soul, would I could bring them back. Being a native son of Shreveport, I can only offer this confession of deep felt remorse over the loss of such fine, outstanding souls." He ended the letter with, quote, "Have wept an ocean of tears, by mournful doth float upon a sea of regret." Yeah, right. The son of a bitch's last meal was lobster tail, butterfly shrimp, baked potato, strawberry cheesecake, and sweet tea. Rawling did not offer any last words. Instead, he sang a gospel hymn, in what the Gainesville Sun described as, quote, "a clear, calm voice that rang through the room." He sang, "Thou art the Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end. The sound of thy voice stills a mighty wind. None greater than thee, O Lord, none greater than thee." Rawling's microphone was finally shut off at 6:01 p.m., and he was pronounced dead at 6:13 p.m. One state's attorney told the Gainesville Sun that it looked like a final stage performance. 47 people showed up to watch his execution. Members of the state's attorney's office, his appellate attorney, and reporters. There were also 16 family members or friends of the college students. Tracy Paulus's parents, Ricky and George, Manny Tabota's mother, Gladys, Sonia Larson's mother, Ada, Krista Hoyt's mother, Anne, and her stepmother, Diana, and Christy Powell's father, Frank, all attended. Other family members were there also. Laurie was there for her sister, Tracy. And there were also 3 members of the Grissom family. Another state's attorney said the penalty wasn't harsh enough. He said, quote, "I'm sitting there watching that, and running through my mind is what I know he did to those kids." A spokesman for the state's attorney's office said he was surprised by Rawling's last words. He said, quote, "I really believed if you were truly sorry and remorseful for what you did, you would say something to the victims' families. But I have to realize who I'm dealing with. We're talking about a serial killer." Rawling's attorney said he wished he had had more influence over his client's final words. He said, quote, "I was hoping he would have repeated to the families what he told me, that he was very remorseful. I think that's what a lot of those family members were hoping for, and they deserved it." Krista Hoyt's stepmother, Diana, said, quote, "I guess this is the final chapter of this book. Maybe now that it's over and we don't have this cause to fight for, we can try and relax and live with the memories of our children." Tracy Paulus's mother, Ricky, said she felt hatred, but kept looking at Rawling during the execution. She said, "I saw his breath go out of him. I was mad all the way through it." Tracy Paulus's sister, Laurie, said, "To watch him disappear, I don't know. I feel a lot better now. Julie Grissom's mom, Joyce, said, quote, "Even though he's gone, it doesn't change the fact our loved ones will never be with us again. It's a type of closure, but it will never, ever bring our children and loved ones back to us. He robbed us of so many things." Outside the prison, death penalty opponents stood in a circle singing Amazing Grace after Rawlings was pronounced dead. Death penalty protesters said the execution only served to provide Rawlings the additional attention he craved as a psychopath. And friends and family did say the execution opened old wounds, but they did not regret it. Diana Hoyt told the press, quote, "This is a tough thing, but is a necessary thing to go through. It is very hard for us to see someone else die, but he deserves it." As I told you in the beginning, screenwriter Kevin Williamson based his script for the movie Scream loosely on the Gainesville murders. He changed the college students to high school students. And while the movie is extremely gory with a high body count, Williamson did not write any sexual assaults into the film. And even so, he and director Wes Craven faced an uphill battle getting an R rating for the movie. The Motion Picture Association of America rated it NC-17 unless there were many changes. Some scenes were trimmed, some cut altogether. Craven actually lied to the MPAA board and said he only had one take of the opening scene when Drew Barrymore's character is murdered. The board allowed the scene to stay in the movie as it was. The film premiered in December of 1996 and became a sleeper hit. It grew in popularity by word of mouth to become one of the best-selling horror movies of all time. And unfortunately, Scream inspired some copycat murders. In 1998, two California teens, cousins, stabbed one of their mothers 45 times, killing her. They confessed and said they were inspired by the movie, and the killing became known as the Scream murder. However, the judge in the case banned all evidence about the movie and refused media access. He kept the trial focused on the murder and not any possible outside influences. The following year, a 13-year-old boy was stabbed multiple times in the head and back by two of his older teen friends. He was saved by an elderly man walking his dog. The teen identified his attackers, who said they had watched the movie before the vicious attack, and there were drawings of the famous mask of Ghostface from the movie found in their belongings. At their trial, physical abuse, drugs, and supposed exposure to black magic in their homes was also blamed. But the 13-year-old victim also testified against them and said he believed they were influenced by the movie. In 2002, a 17-year-old boy in France lured his 15-year-old friend, a girl, out of her house and stabbed her 42 times while wearing the ghost face mask. He ran away when he saw neighbors running to help. The girl identified her attacker before she died. He later told authorities that he wanted to kill someone just like the Ghostface character from Scream had. After the Columbine massacre, the United States Senate Commerce Committee held a hearing about the violent effects of films, video games, and other media. The opening scene of Scream, the murder of Drew Barrymore's character, was shown as an example to the committee. I had heard about the copycat murders and the ratings trouble with the movie, but didn't know all this detail. After researching the movie a bit, I watched it again the other night. One line stuck out to me in the movie. During the final scene, one of the killers said, quote, "Movies don't create psychos. Movies make psychos more creative." The line was a strange premonition of the copycat killings to come. I do not believe that a normal teenager would watch that movie and then decide to stab someone to death, even if it was on impulse. Some people don't realize just how hard that is to do. Movies make it look easy, but it takes great willpower to actually stab a person to death. But what struck me most was a detail I remembered from the Danny Rawlings research. Remember, he claimed that another personality called Gemini killed the students. He stole that straight from the plotline of The Exorcist Part 3. Police knew the movie was showing at the time, and they knew Rawlings had watched it. When one of them finally sat down to watch it, they realized what he had done. This is what I told you to keep in your back pocket earlier. Rawlings cribbed his confession from a horror movie. Danny Rawlings' abusive childhood undoubtedly formed the man he would be. As a society, we still struggle with whether or not severe abuse can be used as a diminished capacity defense. Our laws are very specific. Did the man know right from wrong at the time of the murders? Yes. Yes, he certainly did. These murders were meticulously planned. He stalked his victims, broke in quietly, bringing his own duct tape. Then he attempted to clean all his female victims with dish soap and took the tape with him. That shows he had a fair grasp of how a crime scene would be investigated. He left no prints. And while DNA science wasn't there yet, Rawling was smart enough to know he should try to clean away his bodily fluids. But I don't want to leave you with his name in your head. That's why I didn't name him in the episode title and tried not to say his name in this episode until I got to his capture. Not long after the murders, a memorial was painted on the wall on 34th Street by the University of Florida students. This wall was a place for all kinds of graffiti and where many school events were celebrated. This mural reads, "Remember 1990, forever in our hearts. Sonia Larson, Christina Powell, Krista Hoyt, Tracy Paulus, Manuel Taboda." It has been maintained for over 30 years by UF fraternities and has been a source of comfort for family, friends, police officers, and attorneys who worked the case. No one will ever forget the horror these kids suffered, but we insist on remembering their names. Southern Fried True Crime is written, hosted, and produced by me, Erica Kelly. Today's episode was researched by the one and only Haley Gray. Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio, and the original graphic art is by Coley Horner. Thank you to listener Robert Stroh Jr., who requested this case. Robert also sent me a photo of the 34th Street Memorial that you will see in my social media. Please submit case suggestions to southernfriedtruecrime@gmail.com. I do not accept suggestions on social media. And I apologize if I am unable to answer your email. I get dozens of suggestions a week, and it takes time to go through and check out each case. I will definitely contact you if I plan to use the case you submit to see if you would like to be credited on the episode. Thank you all so much for sending in these suggestions. I truly get my most interesting cases from listener suggestions, so keep them coming. Don't forget to check out our new Facebook group. Search for Southern Fried True Crime Fans Discussion Group. We still worship our patron saint, Dolly Parton. We share fun memes and delicious recipes. Our group is a safe and fun corner of Facebook where we will discuss biscuits and gravy as much as we want to. And by God, we mean it when we say no shit asses allowed. It's not just a motto, it is how we run the group. If you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to subscribe and please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I am also on most large platforms like iHeart, Stitcher, and Spotify, as well as Stitcher Premium, where you can listen ad-free. Until next time. Thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care.